Hello, Mum. We're there to watch a bunch of interesting animation. It's kind of weird. And also, there's Aeon Flux. We're talking about liquid television. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your new favorite show, The More You Nerd. My name is Drew, and I am here to introduce our new topic for the month of April, where we're dipping into music television, but not in the way you might think. We're talking about the MTV eras of animation. Starting off, of course, with the thing that really kicked off a lot of the animation stuff for MTV, Liquid Television, a show and a programming block from the early 1990s. But to do that, I need the interstitial animation that's really weird, but also kind of cool, but it makes you feel very uncomfortable. Miles, how are you, my friend?
That describes me pretty aptly. I'm doing all right. This was an interesting week. I don't remember which one of us suggested that we do this.
I think it was me, based on the reactions that I've gotten from you over the course of this week.
That doesn't mean that I feel like it was like a mutual thing. I think we were kind of came to it, and I was like, let's start with Liquid Television. I think I brought up bringing up the MTV era of animation, and we both agree, well, we got to start here. For those of you who were not yet born and are unaware, or not unaware, but unfamiliar with the time period in which MTV actually played music, which I know always sounds like it's a bit, but like, it's not. Like, MTV used to be MTV, and it really sucks that it's no longer a thing. In fact, one of the episodes that we watched had the commercials still in, and there was this bit where they would like have this like boots on the ground people like explaining or like talking about the nature of MTV and stuff like that. And one kid says, like, specifically, which I thought was really, really interesting, that and if you don't change, you don't grow. And if you don't grow, MTV's not going to make it. And well, that's exactly what happened.
But what's funny about that is I look at that statement and think about this time where this was when, because there was another person in that same thing was like, yeah, some days I'll stay home sick from school and I'll watch MTV and all day. And yeah, I love the music videos, but I don't need to see them three times. And it's like, I mean, like, there is a this though is sort of the time, because this was Liquid Television ran starting in 1991 and sort of stuck around until 95. Yeah. Which is interesting because there weren't that many episodes of this show, so they must have rerun them a lot.
Oh, they reran the crap out of this stuff. And with most stuff from our childhoods, like, there are so many things that, like, I didn't realize was a single season of television, like, growing up. And, you know, revisiting and be like, that's all there was?
Like, Mr. Bean only had, like, 14 episodes or something like that.
Right. And certain shows that like it's only had a single season, but like I only caught it every now and then. So like half the episodes were still new to me, but it only had like, oh, 14, 15 episodes, or it ran for 26. So I think it's important to note that Liquid Television comes at a time, and it is important to note, adult animation has always existed in America. It's always had a space. I mean, you had Ralph Bakshi films, you had Robert Crumb, you always had an alternative angle to comics and animation. That's always existed.
Even shows like the Flintstones were primetime television. They Correct. Were not yes. Saturday morning. They were not targeted as kids. They were targeted at the whole family.
Yeah, it's really the 70s and 80s where this whole animation is for children thing comes from in the States. And most other countries didn't really go through that as much. I mean, obviously, you know, with Japan, very different situation.
Yes.
And this goes hand in hand with the, I think, the beginning of the boom of the popularity of animation, or anime in Japan, because it's around this time you have people starting to get to see like Akira and things of that nature that come out soon afterwards. These crazy adult animation that is clearly influencing some of the things that we see on here. And what Liquid Television does is it gives you all of these bite-sized varieties of animation. I mean, from some that you can hardly call animation to, like, it's called stick figure theater, to, you know, full-on animated episodes that have somewhat of a story. And what this does is it really, like, so much in America is influenced from this moment. So no matter what people think, what I may think of Liquid Television, the influence of Liquid Television from the time it aired and what it bore fruit to cannot be measured, because of Liquid Television, you have things like Daria and the Max and Beavis and Butthead. And because of those things existing hand in hand with the popularity of The Simpsons, which was a primetime sitcom.
For sure.
You have things like, okay, well, Beavis and Butthead was a massive hit. Well, let's give Mike Judge something else. And we get King of the Hill. And we get more and more things outside of that child's space. And this is something even Cartoon Network was doing at the time, not quite as successfully until about the cartoon era in the mid-90s. And I would venture to say, Andrew, you could stop me if you think I'm wrong here, but without Liquid Television, you don't get Adult Swim. Because I think there's a direct correlation between these two.
I absolutely 100% agree with that. Yes, I think that it's whether or not, I mean, because Cartoon Network didn't exist until 95. Is that when Cartoon Network came around?
I don't think that's right. Hold on. I feel like Cartoon Network had been around for a little bit. 92.
So it was post Liquid Television. Now that's not to say that Cartoon Network specifically was influenced by this. I think it was just that Warner Brothers realized they had a number of cartoon shows that they could literally fill an entire day with and did that, because we didn't get Adult Swim until 2002.
Right.
Nope. 2001. It's 2001.
Mm.
And I remember that specifically because it happened 2 weeks before 9/11.
Oh, right. Now, I know that they had, like for Cartoon Network, they did blocks that were very, very successful. And I remember, like, it being packaged in whatever we had, because I think it went hand in hand with, like, Comedy Central. And so I remember having Cartoon Network not too long after it came out.
And this is where we're going to have a conversation now about what cable television was like in the early 1990s, because
wild is what it was.
It was wild. If you lived in a big area, big city or something like that, you might have a couple of different providers that you could kind of go back and forth between. But in the grand scheme of things, and this is still true today if you pay attention to this stuff, you had effectively one provider of cable television in your home. And in my small town in South Carolina, the local television provider did not allow MTV to air on their cable network. So we had cable TV, but MTV was something that I only got access to when we went on vacation to another part of another place mm-hmm. that had different cable.
I do remember that whole vibe. It's when you went to, like, you know, a beach house or something, and it had like crazy channels for
yeah,
the week.
Like I remember watching Beavis and Butthead at a beach house because that was the only time that I could see it. Now, back home, I had Ren and Stimpy, which is a bit of a different, you know, it's one of those things that skirts the line of animation for adults and animation for kids. And we're not going to talk about Ren and Stimpy because of reasons, but
also it sucks. Sorry, I was never a Ren and Stimpy kid.
Anyway, but the short answer is really that we didn't get MTV in my hometown until I was halfway through high school. So I missed out on a lot of this content. So I'm coming to it from a more just fascinated, like, this is what I missed kind of thing. And while we're going to talk about a number of things and some of the stuff that I think really works and some of the stuff that I think really doesn't, it is one of those things that I feel like if I'd watched it at a different era, I feel like it might have awoken something creatively in me that I didn't have. It is funny.
Yeah, so that is... And that is interesting because, and I know why you're saying that, because you lived through this time. So you are able to kind of like maybe posit, oh, well, if I had access to this. And it is interesting because finding something good to watch when you were in a formative age was a big deal. And especially when there was like, it felt like there were so many options, which is like, wow, our heads would have exploded if we saw what we have now. Both good and bad.
Yeah, I don't think we would, based on my children that often talk about how they don't have anything to watch, despite the fact that they have access to literally 85%.
Yeah,
of...
but your kids didn't grow up channel surfing.
No, they didn't. It's paralysis of choice. That's a whole different conversation.
Yes, but... exactly. But I will say, before we get into Liquid Television and the conversation might turn a little more debatey, I think what's so cool about this era was this idea that there were places on the cable landscape where it felt just like we've talked with the Orange Years in Nickelodeon, like it felt like it belonged to a specific demographic, a specific generation, and they were absolutely being catered to. What's interesting to me about the difference between the Orange Years and MTV is the corporate side of MTV is so much easier to see.
Yeah.
and see much more quickly than Nickelodeon. Like, Nickelodeon was a corporation. It was owned by
the same company that owned
the
MTV.
Same company, Viacom, CBS Viacom. And like, so there was a lot of the same corporate overlords, but the way they conducted business at the time and the way that business was seen by the audience were two very, very different things. And that's going to come into play into how I see some of this stuff now compared to how I would have seen it as a kid and how I did see it as a kid. Because I do remember seeing some of these things, specifically Aeon Flux, because I know this one actually got its own shows, but I remember them compiling that first little series into a VHS tape.
Yeah, Aeon Flux was so... Because it looked the way it did, and I don't just mean the fact that Aeon barely wore clothes. I just mean that it looked different and weird and interesting. Mm-hmm. And all of the character designs and all of the costume choices for the soldiers and all of this stuff was just it was fascinating to watch. And I have now in the last week watched the first quote-unquote season of Aeon Flux. And I say season because it's effectively a 12-minute short that was broken up across the 6 episodes of the first season of this. Since they've released it on higher quality, media, I found some other sources that have it higher quality than what we watched here, which is effectively a rip from a VHS tape. And it's just so, like, it's really odd and like compelling, but also challenging. Like, it's challenging you with the stuff that it's showing you, because it's like it's doing some stuff with feet specifically that is that is like, I can't believe they're doing that on television on cable.
Well,
in the 90s.
It's also funny because this is like before like the golden age of like that era of the internet where like feet became a thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the golden, that golden age, get out of here with that.
I mean, you know what I mean though. Like I that feel kind like of the era where like everyone's discovering this stuff exists.
But yeah, like, you know, the WikiFeet didn't exist in 1991.
Right.
But it was just so like, and honestly, I think that's probably, I didn't do enough research on Aeon Flux specifically, but I believe it was created for the purpose of this. And
most likely,
and as a result, like they made a point to like say, and Aeon Flux is next. Oh, Aeon Flux, Aeon Flux, Aeon Flux. Because really that is kind of the key part of this show that's kind of keeping you coming back, like, oh, and you'll notice that because in the first episode, the Aeon Flux segment is very early on, and in the other episodes, the Aeon Flux thing is like the last thing you see.
Would also have like a very iconic, like I remember seeing the eyelashes and the fly bit, like even outside of MTV, like you, that was on comic books and like being heavily advertised elsewhere. Like Aeon Flux would became its own thing.
I sent you a video of a I forget what year it was, but
Super Bowl commercial.
It was the Cindy Crawford Diet Pepsi Super Bowl commercial, where Cindy Crawford turns into an Aeon Flux inspired design because Malcolm McDowell had given her a Diet Coke instead of a Diet Pepsi.
Which is hilarious.
It's so wild. It's so wild. But yeah, well, I want to talk a little bit more about what we see in Aeon Flux, because I think, again, it's something that I've seen bits of it. I don't think I've ever actually watched the entirety of the original arc.
I do not think I have either.
Until now. But I kind of want to talk about some of the other stuff that we saw here, because we're going to be bouncing around a bit, I believe, just because there's
you have
so
a lot of like returning
things.
Gags, and I think this is actually a problem with the show. So I think I have much less of a great time with this than Drew did. And part of it is you watch that first episode and you're like, okay, I can see why this got some traction. This is kind of interesting. And some of these things are really interesting or really funny once. specifically soap opera.
Soap opera, I liked the first one. I didn't mind soap opera because I kept noticing gags that I didn't clock the first time. Like, so soap opera is literally soap.
It's stop motion with real soap products.
And there are bars of soap and there's also liquid soap. And yes, they do the joke you're expecting with that. But it's also little things like the very obvious green bar of soap that you would know at the time of 1991 is the brand Irish Spring has an Irish accent.
Yeah.
Like it's, then there's Soap on a Rope, who is from the bad part of town and is involved the wrong kind of people, because Soap on the Rope is something you would normally see in prisons and stuff like that. It didn't outlast its welcome for me, unlike some of the others.
I got kind of over soap opera just because like I felt like so many bits didn't need to be reoccurring, and there are some bits that like, okay, that worked the one time, and please don't bring that back. Like Miss Lydia's Makeover the Stars.
Miss Lydia's Makeover the Stars was just mean. It was just a
mean
bit.
But also, like the first one they do is Sinead O'Connor, and knowing everything we know about what Sinead O'Connor went through at this time, you're like, this reads very differently than it did
so
in
just,
1991.
Just to explain what Miss Lydia's Makeover to the Stars is it's a faceless character that is seen looking at a computer and typing and basically putting different hairstyles on celebrities. And they do this a couple of times. One of them is Sylvester Stallone, which is honestly just kind of lame, and one of them
it's
is just,
yeah, that's the worst part. Is not only is it mean in the Sinead O'Connor part, it's also just flat out unfunny.
Yeah, the George Michael one that that continually calls him short, and
yeah,
trying to be a big man but not doing it, and like basically,
and she makes that joke with Sly Stallone too.
Yeah, well, because I mean Sly Stallone is short, but
sure.
But yeah, but the Sinead O'Connor one is especially wild just because of what we know. Because this is, of course, it's the Sinead O'Connor after she shaved her head. And so they're putting all sorts of different wigs and different things on her. And it's just like, it doesn't read well. And Miss Lydia keeps calling her a skinhead. And it's like, it's just, it's.
Yeah, it's. I actively disliked that entire bit. And I didn't really care for Art School Girls of Doom either.
So Art School Girls of Doom, it wasn't for me, but it's also that whole thing was cast mostly by two transgender actresses in 1991.
Sure.
So it's one of those things that while it's not for me, I'm sure it meant a lot to somebody,
and that's possibly that could be a thing. I did not look too deep into it. I just thought it was actively unfunny, or uninteresting. It has nothing to do with the cast. It was just like, because it also wasn't really animation. It's like two live action people in kind of an animated green screen kind of thing situation.
Yeah, which they do play around with a lot of different styles of animation. So there are a couple of things like that, like Art School Girls of Doom, where there are live action actors in front of green screens in the background. There's a lot of puppet work. One of the big puppet things that is recurring is Winter Steel.
So Winter Steel is its own thing though.
Is it?
Yes. Because I actively enjoyed Winter Steel.
I didn't enjoy Winter Steel, so that's
hilarious. That's hilarious.
What is the story of Winter Steel? I know it's something that continues into season two.
Yeah, it's
of
a continuing thing. So the story of Winter Steel is basically like she is looking for this guy named Crow, who she grew up with, and either they're going to be lovers or kill each other.
It's tough to say depending on the episode.
Because like, so yeah, it's about this, Winter Steel is like this like blonde female biker. She's in pursuit of her like childhood friend slash maybe ex-boyfriend and maybe a nemesis who's also a biker. And they kind of, they met at this orphanage and bonded, and then they get separated and they vow to find each other. And so Winter is kind of going on a cross-country journey to find him. Crow is also looking for Winter. And so like that's the basic premise. And so what we see is the adventure she goes on while looking for Crow.
Right. But you said it was its own thing. So
Winter Steel was its own like segment. It's not part of the Art Girls of Doom.
Oh yeah, I didn't think it was. I wasn't saying.
Oh, okay. I thought you said it was. And no, I was like, no. Winter Steel's its own thing.
Yeah, I thought you meant that Winter Steel was this thing outside of Liquid Television that I had never heard of before.
Oh no! I'm sorry. I think we just crossed wires.
Okay, that explains quite a bit.
But no, I found Winter Steel to be pretty funny. It's very, very dumb. And I think the person who created Cintra Wilson, I think she was usually known for like irreverent humor. And so I feel like at the time that probably meant something that she was voicing this character.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say the one thing that I loved every part, and this is, I think it's in every single episode as one of the recurring bits.
Oh, I think you're going to bring up the one I hate the most.
Oh, did you hate this one? Invisible Hands?
I don't know. I didn't hate Invisible Hands. I didn't like the
cut up camera.
No, I didn't like that either. No, the one where the one you referenced at the beginning of this episode.
Oh, the psychograms. I didn't dig those at all. I
hated those.
They sound like somebody in 1991 trying to make something dark and mysterious and silly.
Sounded dumb. I didn't care for it at all. No, Invisible Hands. I think if I watched that outside of Liquid Television, I would enjoy it much more than being sandwiched in with a lot of this stuff.
Well, and that's sort of the thing about these, that when you look at these things, because a lot of these things are new for this, but a lot of them are not, that are existing animation shorts that were made, that went around like the animation, like not show circuit. What am I trying to say? The, like, not a convention, but like there are like, I'm losing my ability to speak English, Miles, and I need your assistance.
So some of these things were, I mean, certainly made rounds in little festivals, like
festivals,
you were saying.
Festivals, thank you. That's the word I was trying to get to.
And they would circulate. A lot of these things did circulate, and some of them were very, very popular. And that's how a lot of these artists got this gig. And I love the promise of Liquid Television. I think what bothers me about these first six episodes is, I don't mind that there are recurring segments, because some of them I really like. Invisible Hands was cool. I liked Winter Steel. Aeon Flux is obviously really entertaining. It's the other stuff. Like, I didn't like that each episode kind of felt like, all right, well, I got to wait for this one to go through. And that was a thing with anthology things in the 90s, is like, typically you were going to have like the same bits. Maybe one or two were different per episode. But like, I needed... For me, if they had shown me soap opera once, I would have thought it was hilarious, and I would be talking about it very positively right now. But since I got several soap opera episodes, I found it irritating.
But you're also watching it so close to each other that you're not waiting like week to week to see it, and it's, you're not watching it. I don't even know what the time slot of it was. I'm assuming it was, you know, late on some day.
Yeah, I feel like I remember it coming on. I remember reruns definitely ran later, but I don't know exactly. I want to say maybe it was like 8 or 9 o'clock. And a lot of these were like adapted from like independent comics. Specifically Art Spiegelman. But you also had some interesting stuff. I mean, a lot of these people were early creators. Like we said, we get some Mike Judge stuff in season two.
Looks like it was Sundays based on the air date of the first two episodes.
Okay. But in like episode three, we get a little short by Pixar.
Yeah, which is a Pixar short that was done in like 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And it was short. It was very short.
That's all they did. I mean, until Toy Story, that's all they have are shorts.
Yeah, that's fair. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here, including some stuff that I feel like I had seen before, like Dog Brain, which was one where it was a dog that was dreaming about stuff, and it was like this big fat dog, and he would like breathe in, and his little arm would go up, and he'd breathe out, and his arm would flop down, and I feel like I'd seen that before. I don't know.
That was the one that felt the most familiar to me. So I mean, like I said, I watched some Liquid Television back in the day, but outside of Aeon Flux, a lot of this I just didn't remember, except for that one bit with the dog.
But that's one that was tame enough that it was probably used in some other animation thing, experimental animation thing.
It was
also
short enough. It was probably used as an advertisement.
Could have been. You know, that's a very good point.
I mean, if you look at like, because some of these things that we watched had commercials. And so you see some of the animated MTV logos they were coming up with at the time, like very like alternative comics. And I mean comics with an X, like kind of vibe, you know?
Yeah. So, like, So we've talked a little bit about the sort of repeating ones and sort of I think Invisible Hands. I want to talk about that for a minute before we move on to the next thing. Invisible Hands by Richard Sala, who apparently based this off of a comic book that he wrote. I found a whole that he apparently passed away in 2020 that I did not realize. Yep. That explains why his website had not been updated since 2020. I have to do a little a tiny bit of research now because, let's see. The last post on this is April 18th of 2020, and he passed away in May of 2020. Oh my gosh, that is absolutely wild. Didn't clock that at when I was doing this research. I feel weird about this. He created this comic book that was sort of found as it was an indie comic that was found in the Bay Area by the people that were working on the show, and basically turned the comic book into animation by having him draw the still images, and they would cut out the mouthpieces and make the mouthpieces move in different ways. But it's this sort of like early, like 1920s sort of, like, it reminded me of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, like that kind of vibe of things. Like everything's like everybody's wearing suits and there's gangsters, but there's also like a dude that has mystical powers that can see things, Dr. Z. And I don't know, it worked really well for me, even though it was also very, very silly. And I was like, oh, I would like to see more of this. And he is apparently a guy that was involved in a lot of things. He worked on apparently like Lemony Snicket at some point. Like,
I definitely believe that. Like, I mean, that was the cool thing about Liquid Television. No matter how I feel about some of the episodes themselves, is like you were exposed to like completely different art styles and things that you probably would have never have been exposed to unless you had access to like a cool alternative comic shop. Because even the comic shops that I went to back in the day, they may have had some Image and Dark Horse and maybe a couple things here and there. But some of that other stuff, a lot of that underground stuff, you had to go to like a proper like shop that would like really kind of go into that stuff, or be in kind of a big city like Atlanta or something like that, where like they had these like record store / comic shops that also like had zines, like actual zines.
It's a much more closed loop than it is today, where you can make a, like, you and I have covered and interviewed comics creators that are making stuff like the people that were making this stuff, because they're releasing their stuff online by themselves. You didn't have that in 1991, you know?
No.
It was just not a thing that you had.
No, and even then it was just like you sold stuff piecemeal at indie record and comic book shops that would be friendly to those kind of artistic styles, and you know, hopefully you got some sort of, you know, notoriety for doing something for a DC or a Marvel. Or I mean, like, you look at the career of like someone like Scott McCloud, you know, who nowadays is probably more famous for his understanding comic books than his actual comic book work. Which is too bad, because he's an excellent comic book creator.
Sure.
But you have guys like that, or, you know, what's his name? The American Splendor, Harvey Pekar.
Harvey Pekar, which I didn't know who Harvey Pekar was until American Splendor came out.
Well, no, a lot of people didn't. But you also have like Art Spiegelman, who, like I mentioned before, because a lot of this stuff came as an inspiration from some of his anthology comics. But he created one of the most like popular graphic novels of all time in Mouse. You know?
Yeah.
Like, Mouse is taught in, was probably the first comic book I ever saw taught in schools.
I got a copy for a freshman class in college.
Yeah. I mean, it is an excellent book. He was an excellent comic book creator. And like I love that so much of his stuff has lived on. I mean, he's still alive, so he has continued to work and make new art. But it's just, it's crazy because what makes something like Liquid Television special? What made something like Cartoon or Oddities or any of these anthology, quote unquote, weird shows of this time was that you were being exposed to art that no one else was showing you.
Yeah.
And that to me is the most important takeaway, no matter how you feel about the content. You were being exposed to different kinds of art that, especially if you were in a small town like Drew and I were, like, I wasn't seeing this kind of artwork anywhere else. And some of it I didn't like, but I was still exposed to it. And that's one of the great things about art is you should always be exposed to a variety of styles, even that you don't like, so you can intake it, so you can let it roll around your brain and process, well, why don't I like it?
Yeah.
What is it about this that displeases me? And it informs your own artistic perspective. And I think shows like this, like, I mean, I made a joke about, yeah, let's talk about Liquid Diarrhea for a little bit. Because I didn't have a great time revisiting some of this stuff. But at the same time, I am so, like, thankful that I had something like this as a kid. Because, you know, while people might say there's nothing to watch, once upon a time, that was actually true. You only had X amount of channels, and whatever was on was on. And if there was nothing to watch, there was nothing to watch. And sometimes that was true because it's all paid programming. So, you know, it is a little different than, you know, what did you call it? The paralysis of choice.
Yes.
But I am always thankful because, you know, because I was exposed to stuff like this, you know, I was more interested in stepping outside of what I was reading in Marvel and DC or what I was seeing, you know, in conventional like art spaces of, oh, this is what great artwork is. Okay, yeah, but let me see this. So this is interesting. What is this? Or, hey, I want to check out this comic. And I'll it sounds silly now, but like, look, back in the early 90s, Image was a revelation. And even though they were doing kind of Marvel DC light stuff, it was a bunch of independent creators who formed a company and tried to compete with the big boys. And guess what? They did. Image Comics is still around. And Image Comics, especially in the 10s, was probably the most popular it had ever been and has put out some of the best graphic work of all time.
And has spawned spinoffs of, like, oh, you know, a little thing called The Walking Dead, a little thing called Invincible.
Yeah. And soon to be probably a new Emmy Award winner, Sex Criminals. Like, I believe that was Image as well, wasn't it?
I think so.
At Wicked Divine, which we talked about a couple weeks ago when we were talking about churches. I don't think a lot of kids would have even thought to kind of look at Left of the Dial stuff without shows like Liquid Television.
Whether or not you responded positively to something, this is a show that probably awakened something in you if you watched it at a particular age, at a particular time. And this is where I want to ask you, we've talked about a lot of the recurring bits on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any standalones, just one shots that you kind of were drawn to, that kind of stood out to you?
Yeah. Let me look at what we were doing. This one was super dumb, but it made me laugh. The Press on Limbs.
Press on Limbs was so good. Lee Press on Limbs. It was so funny.
I cracked up. I was like, this is so dumb, but I love it.
It's got that like early 60s aesthetic that was very common for alt stuff in the 90s. That you kind of saw in like it's late 80s, early 90s. You saw a lot of that in John Waters movies. You saw it in Edward Scissorhands, you know. But it's basically just this thing about, oh, you broke an arm. Here's a press on limb. It's just
I just thought that was so funny. Well, I did like the little 30-second beach chair short from Pixar. It didn't, like, speak to me.
Yeah.
I liked the dog bit. I thought that was pretty funny. I think that one recurs at some point in time.
Not in what we watched for this, but maybe it does.
I'm trying to think. You know what? I did not like Cut Up Camera, but for whatever reason, pizza delivery landed for me. Pizza delivery really landed for me. And I like how they're talking about America's Funniest Home Videos. And then, okay, now we're home with Bob. Well, Bob Saget was the host of America's Funniest Home Videos at the time. And it makes him look kind of like Danny Tanner.
But it wasn't just America's Funniest Home Videos. It was America's Funniest Home Videos of, like, such and such and blah, blah, blah.
All the common types of America's Funniest Home Videos, like animals and old people falling down and kids getting hurt. And
it's important to note that Cut Up Camera is, of course, it's animated, but it's kind of a take on, like, a candid camera kind of, like,
yeah.
Do the kids know what candid camera is today? Like
there's enough gotcha shows now that's basically the same thing. If you watch what's the prank show on TV?
The prank show that whose name I can't remember, the something guys, the
Impractical Jokers.
It was Impractical Jokers in the 60s and 70s.
And in the 90s, too.
They brought it back a couple of times.
Also, there's so many YouTube gotcha things that are like that these days. It's like, yeah, it's. But, yeah, I liked that bit. Was there one that, like, stuck out to you that wasn't, a real recurring story?
I've got a couple. One that I didn't really love, but it reminds... So, and later in the season, there was Jack Mack and Rad Boy Go, which was... Mm-hmm. Felt like a proto Beavis and Butthead, even though I don't think Mike Judge had anything to do with it. It was about these two guys that were looking to get some beers. What they call them? Not cold brewskis. I don't remember. But it was this like weird thing where they're just racing down the road. It weirdly reminded me of the anime movie Redline that we covered.
Yeah, because
there was a lot of perspective shifting stuff when they would go super fast, and it was very, very interesting. But there was one in the first episode, Grinning Evil Death, that was wild to me because I'm pretty sure it was mostly CG animation, but was also kind of... I couldn't tell whether it was CG animation combined with 2D animation or whether it was 2D animation on top of CG animation, but it's effectively this thing where there's kind of a thing that, like, Captain Sarcastic, which I don't dig that because that's just meh. It's a very meh joke.
It honestly reminded me of the ads you see in RoboCop.
Yeah, yeah. But then there was a meteor that hits Earth and and it has this, you know, giant super low polygon roach that crawls out, and this kid picks up his Captain Sarcastic ring from a cereal box and goes to fight it. And it wasn't, you know, the storyline wasn't great, but I was just like, this is 1991 and we're seeing something that's combining CG animation with 2D animation, and the 2D animation looks really like high frame rate and really cool when the capes come out and stuff like that, that it just, I don't know. It was interesting and it worked for me. Even though I don't love the actual end product, but like the artistry behind it, I really liked.
I'm trying to think of what else I liked. I remember, oh gosh, which one was it? I think it was called, like, was it Profit and Loss?
I mean, there is one called Profit and Loss, but I don't remember which one it is.
I think that I liked. There was a couple odd bits and bobs here and there that I enjoyed, but for the most part, like, I mean, the Ion Flux stuff was always neat, even though for the most of the run, you have no idea what's going on. You just see that she is sneaking into somewhere and shooting some guys, or avoiding shooting some guys, yeah. You know?
And that is the thing that got me about Aeon Flux watching it is, I know there's kind of two early seasons, which are the shorts that take place over the course of seasons one and two of Liquid Television, and then it gets its own like half hour full show after that. Mm-hmm. There's no discernible, legible dialogue in these shows.
No, I think she goes, ah, once.
Yeah. and there's that news report that's in this sort of... Right. And that was very fascinating to me. But what kind of hit me is that, like, yeah, Aeon Flux. Oh, yeah, it's definitely anime inspired, right? Seems like there's some Ghost in the Shell sort of da-da-da-da-da. The Ghost in the Shell movie didn't come out until 1995.
Oh, the movie didn't.
The manga was out, yes, but the manga and the movie don't really resemble each other that much.
No, stylistically, there's some shared things. I thought it was over there. I forgot I moved it. I was about to grab my copy of Ghost in the Shell, but it's too far back.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it definitely feels like a lot of things that we are familiar with that were popular in the 90s. These things happened. And that style, it kind of feels like a music video that you're watching. And it certainly felt like it was part of that that era of heavy rock and industrial that was utilizing this kind of imagery. It certainly feels like you're watching like the plot of an album cover.
Yeah. And it's especially notable that I think about the early 90s as a particular time, but there's that one episode that had all those commercials, and some of those commercials are proposing a different time than what I was seeing in this show.
Bro, some of those commercials are so wild that I thought they were part of the show.
That too. But what I'm thinking more of is I think of the early 90s, and I understand we're in 91, and that's like slightly too early for grunge to have taken over. But that's... Yeah. Like, when was Nirvana's first album?
Well, Bleach came out in 89.
Was Nirvana's first breakthrough album that people listened to?
Nevermind came out in 91.
So it was out. So the landscape was changing. And we're getting... a deodorant commercial that features girls looking like they're, you know, the like 80s rock style. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a commercial for Dr. Mario, which I thought was hilarious. But
that commercial for Dr. Mario was great and did a better job making me want to play Dr. Mario than Dr. Mario ever has.
Except it didn't use the music from Dr. Mario that I love so much. I love
sure,
music
but like
Dr.
in 1991,
Mario.
How would you know that?
Fair. It's also on Game Boy.
Yeah, I love that. That's a sign. Oh, by the way, you can also play it on Game Boy, which I mean, it's a Tetris like, so that's fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, you're not getting the same experience.
Yeah. But yeah. So as we wrap up talking about Liquid Television, because it's notable that we talked about just the first season, and Aeon Flux is a huge part of that. But it's notable that. You know, this show last, you know, it was basically all in June of 1991, this first show aired, or this first season aired. We get new stuff in September of 1992, a little more than a year later. And there are a number of returning things. Aeon Flux is back, a couple of other things that are return. Winter Steel has a new thing in that one. But one of the big things that was a part of the first episode of season two of Liquid Television, and really probably the thing that changed everything,
mm-hmm.
is a little short called Frog Baseball, starring two characters named Beavis and Butthead. Now, Mike Judge had been in animation for a while. Apparently, in the next episode, his Office Space short aired as part of Liquid Television, which is funny because I saw the Office Space short shorts on Saturday Night Live, but that was years later that they appeared on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And he had a couple of other things. But Beavis and Butthead, I remember being like, Frog Baseball was like, it made news. It made like television history, because there were so many people that were upset about it and frustrated and angry because of what they were showing. This is a cartoon. That means it's for children. And Beavis and Butthead, of course, you know, kind of was that whole thing. Now, they didn't get their, apparently they didn't get their, well, yeah, okay, sorry. They got their own show starting in 1993, which would have just been a year after this. So whether or not this show was greenlit by the time this episode aired, I don't actually know. But there's a lot of stuff that spawned directly out of Liquid Television. Notably, there was a group of programs that they called Liquid Television, or excuse me, it was MTV Oddities, which was where our next entry in our conversation about MTV animation that we still haven't named at the time we're recording this, so hopefully we'll have a good one before we release this episode. Miles, before we move on, any final thoughts on Liquid Television?
Yeah, I mean, we've reiterated several times that, I mean, this is an academically important show, no matter how you feel about the content. And it is worth watching from that perspective. Some of my negative reaction comes from my deep distrust and dislike for our prior generation, Gen X. I promised Drew I wasn't going to go deep into the political nature of that, and I will not. But there was a lot of Gen X humor in here that I just kind of find completely infuriating and falling flat. But I do think this, if you were interested in animation, if you were interested in like kind of academically tracing the roots of some of the things that you probably love, some of it, at least in the United States, begins with Liquid Television in some capacity. It's, I mean, Liquid Television comes from other things, but in terms of something that created a program that became so influential, even if the creators that you love didn't actively watch Liquid Television, they likely watched something that was directly influenced by Liquid Television, or if they were influenced by, like, Mike Judge, well, that's Liquid Television. You know, there is so much here. I mean, Aeon Flux was a cultural milestone through much of the 90s, and then had a box office bomb of a blockbuster movie starring Charlize Theron, which I saw in theaters.
That the creator of Aeon Flux strongly dislikes.
He does. And what's so interesting is, like, he doesn't go off and just, like, throw the hate bomb at it. He just mostly seems sad that the movie wasn't good, which I was like, hey, me too.
I mean, from what I've heard, and maybe this is a conversation for a different topic, but they included no one from the creative staff of the actual cartoon.
I mean, there is that, but also, like, they just, if there's a better metaphor for MTV, it's showing someone the Aeon Flux animated beginnings and then showing them the movie. Because that was MTV. this is the MTV they're trying to sell you. This is what MTV really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, because, you know, as a teenager, I believed in this kind of stuff. And it's like, it sucks that it, like, oh, nope. They were just that. They were exactly what I think about Generation X. yeah. But I do think the show is very important, and I am glad that we watched it despite my constant bitching and moaning about it. and it leads us to better MTV animated shows. It generally does. We have some fun stuff lined up. I forgot what all we're watching this month. So, Drew, what are we watching next week?
So Liquid Television spawned a number of their own, like, because Liquid Television stayed little shorts within stuff. They had a spinoff, MTV's Oddities, was the first of them. And later...
Is that where... was the head coming from that, too?
Was, yes. Okay. So, and Liquid Television also had a follow-up called Cartoon Sushi, which would spawn its own spinoffs several years down the road.
I remember Cartoon Sushi.
Yeah, the Celebrity Deathmatch came from Cartoon Sushi, yeah, as well as a number of other things. But we, our next one we are going to focus on, and we kind of went back and forth on which one we were going to pick. And sadly, neither of these are in the same way that Liquid Television by itself, because it has so much like music content, is just not available. These two are hard to find too. But there is an archive organization that you can find all of this on, and we'll see what the quality of that is. But we decided we are going to cover The Max. Now, The Max is based on a comic book by a creator, Sam Keith, who, and we didn't know this when we set this out, but he passed away last month as we're recording this. Like
like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, like we decided to do this, and then we learned.
I told Drew, oops.
Yeah. So this will hopefully kind of be in honor of him, I hope, because I've never seen this before, so we'll see. But the Max TV series was very short. It was only about, 11 or 12 episodes, and they're all like sort of in the 12 to 15 minute range. So we're going to watch the whole thing. We're going to watch the entirety of what they animated for The Max, which was its own comic book series before and after the animated stuff. But that's what we're going to cover next week. So that's it. Check out The Max where you can find it. Sorry, it looks like 13 episodes. Apologies. So with that said, gang, that is where we're going to end this episode. If you would like to find us, you can find us at themoreyounerd.com, where you can find this and every other episode of our show that we've ever done going back many, many, many years. You can find us on social media pretty much everywhere, either at themoreyounerd or /themoreyounerd. And you can email us themoreyounerd@gmail.com. That's themoreyounerd@gmail.com. You can also find us at the show Cosmic Crit, where me and Miles play tabletop role-playing games with all of our friends, specifically the role-playing game Starfinder by Paizo. It's like Dungeons & Dragons, but in space, with laser guns and spaceships, and it's very cool. You can find us there at CosmicCrit.com, where we are in the middle of our playthrough of our first campaign in Starfinder 2nd Edition, which has been very fun. And if you go to CosmicCrit.com, you can also look in the upper right-hand corner of that site for the link to our Discord, or the Cosmic Crit Discord, which is where you can find your own tabletop role-playing games to play, or you can just talk to me and Miles in the More You Nerd section all day while we are bored at work. So with that said, gang, we're going to end the show as we always do with a rousing...
Nerd out. Two nerd for y'all.